Okay, we're going to move on because the issue of abortion was before the Dáil today, an opposition motion that actually passed. Paul Hosford, what was in it and what happened?
Yeah, so this was People Before Profit TD Breed Smith's bill or motion to expand abortion services. It would get rid of the 3-day waiting period. It would open up the rules around fetal abnormalities. The government had indicated previously in the last day or so that it would allow a free vote on it. It had put forward a counter motion, an amendment that would have basically froze this for a year and would have kind of kicked it down the road for a year, as the government has said that the its response to this review of the operations of abortion services will be kind of worked out in committee. It will be worked out with service providers. Went this evening and the counter motion was defeated fairly handsomely, about 74 to 57. But then when it came to the actual vote, it was Catherine Martin and Neil Richmond who voted with Breed Smith, and it passed by 67 to 64. It moves now to committee stage. It probably won't advance that quickly. It definitely won't advance this side of the summer. Within the government, anyone I spoke to tonight kind of surprised that it went the way that it did. That the
surprised,
vote
surprised, really, yeah.
I think they thought that maybe the votes would hold. Maybe they hadn't whipped it. Maybe they hadn't actually put a head count on it. But I don't get the impression that anyone in the government is kind of rushing to take on this Breed Smith bill and advance it before the summer break, definitely. And by that stage, you're kind of talking, it'll be, by the time it actually reaches committee, it's, you're talking months and months. So the net effect, as opposed to the timed amendment, there's no major difference. But, the fact that it's passed maybe puts a bit more pressure on Stephen Donnelly to come up with an answer here.
Right. Thomas Pringle, do you think it accelerates it any more than the government's 12-month kick it down the road proposal? Do you think it
I'd love to think it would, but unfortunately I don't think it will. The government will make sure to bury it in committee, like we've seen other bills have been buried in committee and they just stay there and die a death, unfortunately.
Does it not change the complexion of it, though, if you've got two ministers, one from Fine Gael and one from the Greens, who, if they're willing to go and put their name to it, that would suggest they're willing to advocate for the proposals proposed in it?
Well, it's a bit of a leap to think that it would suggest they're willing to advocate for it. But yeah, look, I mean, obviously they made the decision and they voted the way they did. And that has pressured the government. And it's obviously a pressure that the government didn't want. They wanted to kick it to touch. But I don't think, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to actually mean that it's going to pass any quicker, sadly. But I think if the government was right, and the government, if we had a proper government, that it would pass quicker, but that's not going to happen.
Right, Gary Gannon?
Yeah, I think it's important to say that the government's intention to pass it down the road for 12 months would have coincided with another 360 women having to travel probably over that same period. When we voted in 2018, we went to the polls for healthcare at home. I think the motion today with PBP also coincided with the review that was brought to committee by Mary O'Shea, which made a number of legislative changes and operational changes that were very similar to the PBP motion.
We will get to that, and we want to hear a bit from that committee in a minute. But do you think that the 12-month time frame that was wanted by government, do you think that's altered in any way, despite the fact that this bill passed? Do you agree with Thomas Pringle? It'll be bogged down.
I hope it would be, but I don't believe it's going to accelerate at all.
Right. And even the fact that a free vote was offered and two members of government, you don't think that's going to change?
I think it was very telling that the Minister for Health came in after the vote. He voted on the next, which was our own motion, actually. The Minister for Health actually missed that particular vote and came in for the next vote, which kind of gave a little bit of a tell to me in terms of where the priority wasn't going to be. Now, I don't doubt for a second in terms of people appreciating the seriousness of this, but I don't think that vote is going to accelerate the type of recommendations we've seen from PBP today, but also from the expert review.
All right, Lisa Chambers, what would your expectation be? I mean, the proposal there by government to wait 12 months, but then offer a free vote, which does leave open the possibility that this bill could have been carried and could be in quicker than they might have recommended.
The bill tonight won't ever be enacted, is my take on it. I'm not a member of the Dáil, but it'll never be enacted. My take on it is that the 12 months that the government was seeking was to allow the report that's newly published, that was commissioned independently, to actually go before the Health Committee, to have it done at a committee level, which is the way we've done all of the I suppose, abortion legislation and report. I was set on the Oireachtas 8th Amendment Committee last term, so I was part of that committee process, and that was the intention, was to follow the same process again. So I really wouldn't read anything into the timed amendment or the minister not being there for a vote. My own view on this, as somebody that campaigned for repeal, as somebody that probably set aside from most of my parliamentary party and took and voted yes in that particular referendum, I certainly, and many others, made a very big virtue at the time of that vote of presenting to the people what we would do as a legislator if they removed the Eighth Amendment and allowed the Oireachtas to legislate. We presented the bill and we told people what we would do. And we made a promise on that day, I believe, that we wouldn't go any further and that we were going to do certain things. So I have a real issue with some of the stuff that People Before Profit are looking for. The removal of the 12-week limit, that was the crux of the debate last time. We presented to people the 12-week limit, and that's what we asked people to vote on. And we also made a promise, even though there were allegations from the no side that, oh, this will be the thin end of the wedge, and once you open it up, they look to expand and make it more liberal. I certainly, during that campaign, said that was not my intention and I wouldn't support that happening. So I think we need to be very careful. We're not that long since the vote, as somebody that campaigned for repeal, not that long since the vote, and my view is that the bill that was tabled tonight certainly expands the remit, or it certainly expands access
from your point of view as a member of a government party, but from the point of view of People Before Profit in campaigning for this.
Oh no, I get that.
That's consistent with their position.
Absolutely, that's consistent with their position. I'm just making the point that we made a really big virtue out of presenting to the public what we would enact, because obviously removing the Eighth Amendment and inserting a provision to allow the Oireachtas to legislate, we told people what we would do.
Okay.
So seeking to expand it to this extent, I believe, goes beyond what we told the public we would do at that point.
Tom Springle, I'll bring you in first.
Yeah, yeah, whatever about the People Before Profit Bill, but the legislation that was actually passed included a time frame for review and looking at how that legislation
I'd like to
was,
respond to that point as well, actually, because you're correct,
So we've put that before the people, so that's just as equally as important as the fact that the legislation has to be reviewed and see how it's operating, and the recommendations for the amendment of that legislation as well.
But Thomas, do you not agree, and I accept that there is in the legislation that we would review how it's operating. My view on it is that the intention behind that was to review what we enacted, not to review
and
whether
throw it out then if it wasn't working.
Well, I would say we'd be focusing on things like is there equal provision across the country? Is what we agreed to
that's
do? Are we doing it?
That's an operational issue.
I don't think that the intention to review was to widely expand.
It's really important. We campaigned, and people campaign for different reasons, but fundamentally we campaigned so we could have healthcare at home. And we can't step away from the fact that following the review that was presented today and the evidence that was captured in that review, we still have a scenario where over 300 odd women are travelling every year to another jurisdiction to get healthcare. So, I mean, there was a provision in the legislation that we would review and we would make changes where necessary. And that's what's come to the fore in the 5 years since and the 3 years since the legislation was passed. So I think that's what was captured today. There was a request today from Mary Shea for courage from politicians to actually enact these legislative changes. I think there was a special committee in terms of the review and the Eighth Amendment. Kicking it back to the Health Committee to go around for another year doesn't really reflect the fact that there is an urgency here.
I just want to clarify something on the vote this evening about the Green Party and how they voted. It was all the Greens voted except Eamon Ryan, that should be pointed out. Just been asked to clarify that. You mentioned the committee there, Paul Hosford. Who is in front of the committee today? Mary O'Shea and Catherine Conlon, the authors of this commissioned review that's been referred to here. We might as well get into what happened at the committee today and tease out some of that. They were there to present to the Health Committee on what?
On the recommendations, on this report that came out last month. A lot of the focus today has been on Mary O'Shea's response to what the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste said when this came out at the end of last month. Now, they both said, similar enough to what Lisa has touched on, that there was a campaign in 2018 that was focused around this, you know, it would have a 12-week limit, it would have a three-day waiting period.
Right. Let's hear what she had to say, seeing as you say that, yeah.
I heard the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste refer to needing to give this consideration and the breach of promise with the electorate and this slow and steady sort of approach to it, whereas really this is a health service that was developed and was put into implementation in 2019. If it was any other health service being designed by the HSE, they now have these specialist clinical directorates. They don't launch new health services unless they are evidence-based, and then they pilot them, and then they amend them. And it's only when they're satisfied that they're capable of being implemented and are reaching their objectives, it's only at that stage they are rolled out. So I find that attitude as to, you know, what does the electorate think about it to be a little disconcerting. I certainly found those two comments disappointing.
Paul Osridge, that's got quite the reaction today, didn't it?
Yeah, and it's fairly strident, I suppose, pushback against what the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste said. But when you look at some of the examples that Mary O'Shea gave, she talked about people having to pay €90 for taxis to go to GPs. She talked about one woman who looked for an abortion on Christmas Eve but was told that by the time the clinics reopened after her three-day waiting period, she would be beyond the 12-week waiting period, so she wouldn't actually be able to access an abortion over that Christmas period. Talked about families with fetal abnormalities who had to travel to England twice for the same thing in two different pregnancies. Talked about a lot of the issues around the operation of this abortion legislation and really kind of pointed to a lot of the flaws, a lot of the problems that are arising with it. David Cullinan asked her straight out, is there a medical reason for the three-day waiting period? And bluntly, she just said no. Absolutely no medical reason for it. I suppose the logic for it at the time was that it would kind of give people a chance to wait, to change their minds. But we know from what little data there is available on this that only about 1% of people actually do change their minds about accessing an abortion along the way.
And again, that's what limited, as you say, information there is. There are 3,951, according to the HSE, people turned up for their first appointment but didn't proceed to abortion. But the why of that isn't known. That kind of touches on what Padraig Tobin was asking about, because I suppose as his specific reason for leaving Sinn Féin was because this, for him, is not, and for people who support him and for 34% of people in the referendum, isn't just a legal and medical issue, it's an ethical and moral issue, and that was the line of his questioning. Let's hear from him at the committee today.
Have you spoken to any women who went through that three-day wait period and decided to go ahead and have their child?
No, I haven't, no.
Is that not a major absence in relation to this? Because you have spoken, in the evidence that we've heard today, you have spoken to many people, many, many people in relation to this.
Mm.
Key element of your proposal and the group of women, maybe up to 2,000 or 3,000 women, given the figures that we know, and yet nobody has spoken to them and asked them, was that a beneficial three-day period to be able to weigh up this enormous decision?
Our research was tasked with speaking to service users who had used unplanned pregnancy and abortion care supports. So we actively sought out anybody who were anywhere along that care pathway. And within that, there wasn't anybody who had used either counselling services or their first consultation with the GP who had opted out after the three-day wait. So that's in relation to the group of people we spoke to.
And that was Mary O'Shea, to Catherine Connell, should I say, speaking to Padraig Tobin about the three-day waiting time. It's a grey area, isn't it, Lisa Chambers, that we don't know why 3,951 people didn't go forward for the second appointment, whether it's some of the reasons that the people contributing at the committee today say that they went elsewhere, or indeed that they decided to proceed with the pregnancy, or that they miscarried.
Yeah, like it's not an unreasonable question by Padraig Tobin, and it's not often I would be in the same space as Pather on this issue when we are on completely different sides of the debate on the last occasion. But I think it was a fair question for him to ask. On the three-day waiting period, it was part of a number of measures to try and ease the concerns of those that were maybe on the middle or on the fence and didn't really know what to do, but were feeling emotionally wanting to do what they could to allow women to make that choice themselves in the most difficult of circumstances. I myself think that by the time a woman has made a call to a GP, she's already thought about it at length. So I'm not sure there's a need for that three-day waiting period. But, you know, look, this will be always an emotive issue. We're trying to balance something that's extremely challenging to balance.
That's the point, isn't it, Gary Gannon? Because what was said at the committee today by the two rapporteurs was that this really wouldn't apply to any other part of the health service. But it's not any other part of the health service, is it? I mean, the right to life for the unborn was enshrined in the Irish Constitution, effectively became what, you know, you were taking a category of what had been a person out of the Constitution and was changing that category, which, regardless of what your point of view, morally or ethically or legally or whatever about it, makes it a different issue.
No, Colm, I'm sorry, I don't agree that it does. I think this is an absolutely essential part of a person's and a woman's healthcare. So I actually don't believe a three-day waiting period has any particular benefit when a person seeks...
No, I'm not talking about the benefit of it. I'm saying the issue of abortion, sure, but it is, in the context of this country, is different to other healthcare issues.
That's
I'm sorry, in the context of a person's healthcare, it's not. So I actually don't accept that.
I think after... there is no other health issue that we had a 35-year national debate on.
Sure.
This is not the same. This is not just annual.
Well, we had a 35-year national debate because of the history of this country, which doesn't need a lot, wouldn't leave a lot to be desired in relation to it. Mm. You know, and so it is peculiar to Ireland, but that doesn't make it right. It's peculiar to the situation and the legal situation that we had in Ireland, but that still doesn't make it right. You know, and the reality is that women shouldn't be forced to wait the 3 days, and the reality is that it is affecting women and making decisions in relation, which should be a decision that should be totally between them and their doctor.
Sure.
And their partner.
But in terms of going back to the point on the referendum, 75% of people who voted in favour of repealing the Eighth Amendment always knew they were going to vote that way. That's according to the RTE exit poll that was done on this. Only 12% of them changed their mind during the referendum campaign. Some of them may or may not have been influenced by the three-day waiting time. But Thomas Pringle, we've seen European referendums with government approach being criticised on neutrality and all of these other things. And the constant refrain is, you say one thing at referendum time, you change your mind afterwards. Is it not another one of these issues where public faith in promises made at referendum times should be stuck to?
No, well, the legislation that was put before the people, and the people knew that was actually going to be the legislation that would be passed on foot of the referendum, provides for a review to take place of the operation of the legislation. And for a review to take place, it means that if something's not working, that it be fixed as well. And it's not working and forcing women to have a three-day wait, and that is the reality of the situation. And I would ask anybody to say that that is working and that should be there, it shouldn't be there. And the reality is that this is a situation that's between a woman and their doctor, and that's it.
Lisa Chambers, would you accept that a lot of the operational difficulties are symptomatic of gaps in the health service in general? The absence of GP services, the difficulty in recruiting specialist obstetricians and gynaecologists, those kinds of issues are part of the reason that these services are not widely available around the country.
That and conscientious objection as well. There are some GP practices and doctors that just won't engage in this service, and that is something we've accepted that we're not going to force doctors to do. And I think you'll see a generational shift as younger GPs come into the practice, that will over time ease. I mean,
your
I think
preference is to let demographics look after that, isn't
well,
it?
Well, not let it look after it, but I'm just pointing out the facts of the situation. We have a lot of service providers that don't want to engage in that service. We knew that before we provided the service and legislated for it, we knew that was going to be an issue. And we are improving access to services all of the time. I think in the next year we'll be down to just 2 maternity hospitals not providing those services. I think we're currently maybe 6 or 7 now that don't. So we are working on that, and that is a priority. That's where I think the focus needs to be in terms of, you know, we said we would provide a certain level of service with certain restrictions, and we're not doing that yet. That's where my focus would be. There are parts of the country, particularly in rural areas, where you can't access those services at all. And that's the cost that was being pointed out to. So the 3-day wait period, that's not the big issue. It really isn't. If we're talking about the bill that was in the House tonight, it's when you start looking to change the 12-week limit, that's where the big debate was. And that's where it will continue to be. The 3-day wait period, that's not the thing that's really concerning most people. I think there's going to be flexibility around that. I haven't met anybody that's really stuck to wanting to keep the 3 days, to be quite honest. I don't think that's the crux of the debate.
All right. Conscientious objection, Gary Gannon. Would you be comfortable with a hospital's recruitment practices discriminating against people who might have a conscientious objection to providing a particular service?
I think it's important that we preserve conscientious objection, but we also have to weigh that against equally to a person's right to access healthcare. So I do think that if a consultant, like was recommended today for the new consultant's recruitment process, we do need to see if they're going to provide the full range of medical services. And I think that's absolutely fine. I think that's in keeping with employment law. So yes, absolutely conscientious objection, but we also need to ensure that we can staff our hospitals with people that provide a full range of medical services.
Thomas Pringle?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that in the recruitment process, it's legitimate, I think, to ask that whoever that is being recruited, that they would provide the services that are being available at that particular hospital at the time.
Is there an argument for, and, you know, again, this is the peculiarity of the issue in Ireland, in that conscientious objection was built in, which arguably makes it not just another part of the health service, that you would have additional staffing and resources provided to hospitals to avoid it being a zero-sum game between conscientious objectors and people willing to provide the full service?
Well, I think if somebody has a conscientious objection to providing a service, they have an obligation to a patient to actually make sure that they can access the service if they require it. They have an objection to providing the service themselves. That's fair enough. But I think that they would have to, you know, they have a duty to a patient as well to actually put them in place and contact with somewhere.
And that was one of the issues at the committee today, wasn't it, Paul Osborne, that there is an issue around people not abiding by the obligation, where if they are not willing to provide that service, to refer people on to somebody else who is willing to provide it, or at least even back to the HSE.
Yeah, and that is one of the things that the rapporteurs pointed out, was that you were basically getting parts of the entire country where you just couldn't access or find a referral to access. And that, you know, I suppose one of the issues that you come up against with that is that 12-week waiting period. If, you know, Mario Shea said that, look, one of the issues here is dating pregnancies. People find it very difficult sometimes in certain situations to actually date it. They don't know. So when they do make that first contact, if they're being essentially given the runaround, that it kind of eats into that time. And that's where they find themselves up against that part of the legislation.
Right, that's, Lisa Chambers, a difficulty with the whole conscientious objection thing. If somebody conscientiously objects to providing abortion as a service, they conscientiously object to its very existence. Mm-hmm. Expecting them to go against their conscience and refer on somebody to get an abortion is one of the difficult grey areas of conscientious objection, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. I mean, we were focusing there on hospitals and access to services there. A lot of the time it's the GPs, because really that's where your first port of call is. And, you know, at a certain stage in the situation, it could be a prescription of a tablet as opposed to having to go in for any procedure. Mm-hmm. So it's GPs. And yes, we are hearing anecdotal evidence that there are GPs that are not referring on to another GP when they're not willing to provide the service. I can't point you to a particular GP. I have no evidence to show of anyone not doing it. But yes, we're hearing that back to a certain extent. So it is something we're trying to address. But I think people will appreciate and understand that that's quite a challenge, where we have a shortage of GPs, some of a certain generation, and people have the entitlement to choose not to provide.
I think that the two rapporteurs talked about people who have rung around. Was it seven GPs? Somebody had rung around seven GPs before they found somebody who actually would provide the service.
Yeah.